probably have taken the lead. Burrison is picked off, intercepted by Norwood, and he's down to the goal line, and they'll mark him down at the one. Second and 10, Burris under pressure, and he is dropped. Ryan Hall in there early. Yeah, players onside. The pooch kick. So this can be recovered by the Ticats. One of the onside players. He's got it. Off and running. Rico Murray. Touchdown.
Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham.
So, Mike, last week I went to Ottawa to take in the Ticats Red Blacks game, and I had a great time. I love the city. I don't know how many times you've been, but I've been now 5 times in the last 6 years. This was the first time I've ever gotten a chance to go for a football game. And wow, that stadium, tip of my hat to everybody in Ottawa for what they've done there. The stadium is absolutely beautiful. The development around Lansdowne is incredible. There's always this talk about how building stadiums will increase businesses in the area, and that rarely, if ever, happens. I know there's not a ton of businesses springing up around Tim Hortons Field here in Hamilton, but holy smokes, the stuff that has popped up around TD Place in Ottawa it's incredible. There's restaurants, there's a movie theater, it's become its own little community. And after the game, I went out and met with some people, and the bars and the restaurants around there were packed. We had to walk a good 10 minutes away to find a place where we could sit down and have a beer and have a discussion about, you know, I've just chit-chat about stuff. I was in the heart of the enemy den, so it was just me and a bunch of Red Blacks fans. I don't know if you listen to the Bleed Red Blacks podcast, but one of their co-hosts, Mike, came out with us, and Janin, who does the Around the CFL segment for them, was there, and a couple other Red Blacks fans were there as well, and it was just a fun time. Ottawa's a great city. I love going there, and this was probably my favorite road trip so far. The only one that I think can even touch it was my trip to Moncton, but that was a different type of fun than this. I'm not the most outgoing of people. I like to keep to myself, and this kind of got me out of my shell, and it was a really fun time, and if you ever get a chance to go to Ottawa, Mike, you have to do it. It is absolutely amazing there.
Yeah, I was there once during the Renegades run, and I had a great time, too. I'm sure it's not the same. Well, I know it's not the same as it was then. I'm sure it's a lot better. You know, like you were talking about, there's so many businesses around the stadium, and the stadium is so... it was renovated, so we were talking before the show, and you said it's beautiful. So I think there was a plan to build around the stadium before they actually started building. So yeah, bars and all that stuff. So it sounds like a great time, and I'd love to go watch a game there maybe next season.
They've done it right. It's the only way I can put it. They took their time. They built everything up, and like you said, it seems like they had this plan to build up the infrastructure around it before the stadium was even there. It was just an amazing experience. And interestingly enough, you and I are kind of well-known. I was bumped into by a bunch of people, both Red Blacks fans and Ticats fans. There were a ton of Ticats fans that made the trip. They knew me from the podcast and from the Three Down Nation website, so if you go to Ottawa and start walking around there, you might get spotted too. We're kind of minor celebrities.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know if they'd recognize me or not, but I don't know if they've seen a visual of me, but maybe I'll get a Mike_Ticats jersey or something.
They'll recognize the voice. I've been recognized by my voice before, so they'll definitely recognize you by your voice. I'm just saying, it was really interesting to just walk around and have people go, "Hey, you're that guy who does that thing," and I'm like, "I am that guy that does that thing." And it, imagine if we were together, they would have thought that we were like a couple or something.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess we got to get into this game that happened. Ticats go into Ottawa. They at least made a game of it this time. This was a much more exciting game than the week before. There was actually touchdowns scored for a change. But again, they came out on the losing end, 44-28, and the Red Blacks, I can't believe we're saying this, finished 12-6 and won the East Division. It's mistakes, man. It was just mistakes. The Ticats had a ton of opportunity to seize momentum in this game. They did so in the second quarter. They were down 17-0, and then in the second quarter, they scored 20 straight points, and it's like, holy crap, they're going to do this. They made a game of it. They score a touchdown with, what, like 3 seconds remaining in the half to take the lead? Looked like everything was going Hamilton's way, and then you think that they're going to turn the corner. They get the fumble on the Jamil Smith hit. Simone Lawrence scoops it up, rumbles like 60-some-odd yards down inside Ottawa's red zone. You're thinking, okay, they'd given up some points to Ottawa. I think they were down. I think it was 31-26 at the time. But you're thinking, okay, they can put it in here. They can sort of take back momentum, and this is looking good. What happens on the very next play? Sean Lemon gets in the backfield. Masoli fumbles. Ottawa recovers, and it was pretty much game over from there. Just a disappointing effort by the team when it came to not making these critical mistakes.
Yeah, it was a disappointing finish, but one of the more interesting games that I've seen this season. It was definitely fun to watch up until the actual loss from the Ticats. But yeah, the mistakes really killed us. I mean, like you just said, yeah, that's such a big play from Simone Lawrence getting the ball on the fumble, returning it so far. I thought he was going to score the touchdown, but he got caught from behind. But yeah, and then the next play, Mazzoli fumbles. So I thought Mazzoli came in and looked pretty good. I thought that he really sparked the team because Ja'Cory Harris, he wasn't doing so hot. He seemed to just be confused. You know, there was a lot of two and outs when he was in there. And then once Mazzoli came in, he was running the ball a bit more and got the team going. So I guess if I had to, maybe Matthews comes back next week. Maybe he's recovered from his concussion. But if I had to bet, I'd say that Mazzoli would get the start in the playoff game.
I'm thinking you're 100% correct there. I was impressed is the wrong word to use, but Masoli's previous endeavors on the field have been a bit of a train wreck. He had that terrible start, I believe it was against Calgary last year, and my big takeaway from him from last season was he had that goal line fumble against the Argos on Labor Day. Do you remember that?
Yep.
And it was like the kid couldn't get out of his own way. So when he came into the game, I was really worried that this thing, because at the time I believe it was 17-0 for Ottawa, and this game looked like it was already getting out of hand. And then he made some nice throws, and he picked up first downs, and the defense and special teams gave him some field position, and he capitalized on it most of the time. It just seems like the game was too big for Harris. Like, he got the start, but was never truly comfortable there. And like you said, Mazzoli provided a spark. But you just can't have these devastating turnovers after the defense comes out and gets you the ball back. And the defense did give up 44 points. There's no denying that they weren't at their best. But they got sacks. They got turnovers. They forced Ottawa off the field on a number of occasions. The special teams came through with some big plays. Brandon Banks had the first ever two-point convert on a missed extra point in league history. Terrell Singfield had that great punt return that he nearly scored on that set up, I believe it was Andy Fantuzzi's touchdown at the end of the first half. They got contributions from all the other areas of the team, and the offense was decent, though not great. They just kept making these dumb mistakes, and it still wasn't enough to get the win. They still lost by two touchdowns, two-point converted touchdowns at that. I got to be honest with you. I'm really worried that this team might not make it through the playoffs and might not even be able to get one win.
It's going to be tough. I mean, you know, Toronto's no slouch. They got Ricky Ray back in there. He only had a quarter of play or a quarter and a bit his last game, but, you know, through a touchdown pass, he looks to be maybe back on track after his injury. You never know. But yeah, there was just, Cary Grant had a really tough game as well. He had a couple of drops and one huge drop in the fourth quarter, I believe, that should have been a touchdown. I mean, Mazzoli placed the ball perfectly on a long pass, and it looked like the Ottawa defender jumped up, tried to block it, and maybe distracted Grant, but it essentially like fell into his hands, and he just couldn't make the catch. So, you know, he was a disappointment in this game because, you know, I think he had at least one more drop that was an easy catch. So that, you know, that play in the fourth could have really helped the team because he probably would have walked into the end zone if he makes that catch. So I was impressed with Mazzoli's deep balls. I thought they were really accurate. You know, he just kind of floated it up there and placed, it wasn't like on a line or anything, but it was just, a lot of them were perfectly placed, like pretty much the BS offensive pass interference call on Underwood. I'm not sure what quarter it was. It was earlier in the game, but that was a perfectly placed deep pass as well, and it should have been a huge gain down to about the 4-yard line. So going forward, I think it has to be Mazzoli if Matthews isn't back.
Grant did have a tough game. He also took that penalty when he headbutted the Ottawa defender that, after he made a catch and picked up 5 or so yards, took him back to second and 15, I think it was. And that was when the Ticats then tried the onside punt that they scored on. So I guess it didn't hurt the team that much. But again, second and 5, they're, again, building a little bit of momentum here, and you're thinking maybe they can do something. And again, another mistake dooms the team. It's just – and from a guy like Bakari Grant, he's a 5-year veteran. He should know better than this. Still, it was disappointing. But I'm glad you brought up the blown calls, because there were a ton in this game. You talked about Masoli's nice touch on his deep passes. He had another one in the game that went to Luke Tasker that from – all angles looked as if he was interfered with. Ticats challenge, and basically before the flag even hits the ground, the review crew comes out and says it wasn't pass interference. It was ticky-tacky at best, but it definitely looked like the Ottawa defender may have had his hand on Tasker's wrist or upper arm. And then you bring up the Underwood offensive pass interference call, which it's been talked about ad nauseum, but like that was, if that's pass interference, then breathing in the direction of a defender or a receiver is pass interference. That was absolutely an insane call.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, that was a huge play to take back for that. Barely even touched the guy, and I guess we're going to have to talk about the CFL admitting the blown calls from last week. So this just continues the trend of bad refereeing in two straight games, and two huge games for both teams. And it sucks to watch a game when the refereeing changes the game so much, because it shouldn't be about that. It should be about the players, not the referees.
I want to make it clear before we get into a rant on this that I'm not blaming the refs for the loss. The Ticats did more than enough in both of these games against Ottawa to cost themselves the game. But that said, the refereeing needs to be fixed. This is reaching a point of absurdity. You cannot be getting these calls. Like, you brought up the play from a week ago. The CFL came out and admitted that those penalties on the Brandon Stewart interception return for a touchdown were wrong. They did, quote unquote, did not meet the standard that they set for penalties on those types of calls. That wiped out a touchdown on the Ticats part that would have put them up. Now, maybe they win that game, maybe they don't win that game. That's not for us to decide, but it definitely played a factor in the outcome of that game, which then plays a hand in how this game in Ottawa was going to be played. Ottawa would have ended up winning the season series based on total points anyway, but that's beside the point. We cannot have the integrity of the game being questioned to this degree all season in every game for every team. We have seen terrible call after terrible call. The one that stands out to me as probably the worst of all of them was in that Winnipeg-Calgary game, where the Winnipeg receiver checked with the referee to see if he was onside on the line of scrimmage. The referee said yes, and they threw a flag on him for illegal formation. Essentially cost the Bombers a shot to win or tie that game. At some point, the league's got to come out and figure out a way to fix this. I think we had a question last week about how to fix the refereeing system, and we were talking about maybe making them full-time or whatever it is. I don't know what the answer is, but something's got to be done. This cannot continue.
No, and, you know, that Winnipeg play cost them the game. It could have cost them the season, too. It could have cost them the playoffs. So on more than one occasion, the CFL has come out and said, yeah, the refs blew the calls in games. So when the league's admitting it so much, it's just tough to take the refs seriously when there's so many mistakes in games. I mean, yeah, it's a tough job, but it just needs to be better. It has to be better going forward. And I don't know how, like we talked about it last week, and it's tough to fix, because I don't necessarily see the CFL doing anything about it. They haven't done anything about it for years and years and years. So it has to be fixed, but I don't know how it's going to be fixed.
Do you think maybe this is the part where they essentially make every play reviewable? Because that seems to be the only way that this is ever going to get fixed, honestly. I don't see any other way to do this other than just say, if a play happens on the field and you're a coach and you want to challenge it, you can challenge whatever you want.
Yeah, I don't really have a problem with that, because, you know, the amount of challenges doesn't change. So, like, they won't be able to challenge every single play, because that's always a concern, you know, slowing the game down so much with so many reviews. But if they have the same amount of challenges and they can just challenge whatever they want, then I wouldn't have a problem with that, because it won't change the amount of reviews.
I just think that it's more important to get the calls right. If these games last longer, I'd rather them last longer and have the correct calls be made than us sitting here a week later discussing all these mistakes the refs made and discussing the league coming out admitting these mistakes. Let's find a way to fix this, and if it has to be, let's make everything reviewable, then so be it.
Yeah, I'd have to agree, because you just have to get them right, and that's it. Better to be longer than to have plays by the refs that are just changing the game than the outcome of the game.
Well, let's wait and see if a Grey Cup is ever decided on a borderline or even blown call. And then maybe that's when they'll finally get their heads out of the sand and figure out that they got to make a change. Because until it reaches a point where people are sick of it and are not tuning in or are not going to the games, they really don't have any incentive to change. But this is it's just frustrating. As a fan, it's just frustrating.
Getting back to the game a bit, I just wanted to talk about the onside punt working again to perfection. I mean, I would have sworn that they would have seen this coming. I mean, the ball went right by the Red Blacks returner, and just easy pickup for the Ticats on special teams and, you know, walk into the end zone. So, you know, I don't know if they're going to try that again in the playoffs. They seem to do it. They seem to do it when they need to. So, I guess Toronto must, you know, they have to be on the lookout for this going into the playoff game, because if they're not, then they're just being unprepared, in my opinion.
Well, I had a very unique perspective on this, because that when Rico Murray picked up the ball happened right in front of me. I was five rows up from the field at around the 25 or so yard line. And when that ball bounced, it looked like it bounced in between two Red Blacks return men almost. And then they just didn't really bother to pick it up. And then you see Rico go in. And as soon as I saw it happen, I was like, oh my God, you could see them even where I was sitting, that there was, I think it was three players were looping around Medlock. And I'm thinking, holy crap, they're going for the onside punt. And then when I saw it bounce and I saw Murray there pretty much running full speed, pick it up off the hop, I went crazy, because I think that made it at the time 31-26. So it was like, holy crap, okay, maybe this is a momentum changer. And I was sitting next to mostly Ticat fans, but there were a few Red Blacks fans around. There was this older lady, probably in her 40s or 50s, who was like, how is that not a penalty? And I explained it to her, and then she said to me, well, why would anyone ever do that? And I didn't have the heart to tell her, because I was trying to be nice. But in my head, I'm thinking, because it just worked. They scored a touchdown. That's why you do it. And like you said, Hamilton has perfected this. They've been doing it all season. And you're darn right. The Argos better be prepared for it, because the first time the Ticats did it this year, they burned the Argos for a touchdown when, I believe it was A.J. Jefferson, just kind of stood there as Brandon Stewart picked up the ball and ran into the end zone. So I think they'll be well prepared for this come Sunday. But, yeah, what an exciting play.
And then another exciting play was the Brandon Banks 2-point return, which has never been seen before. The Milo misses the extra point, and then Banks takes it back 100 and whatever yards it was for 2 points, and you know that got them within 9. So you know maybe there's a chance that they can still come back. It didn't happen that way, but it's a long ways to run for 2 points. But it was sure exciting. And you know, Brandon Banks was injured earlier in the game. It looked pretty bad on TV. He got out of his equipment and he looked pretty upset. And I thought maybe it was a dislocated shoulder and he might be out for an extended period of time. And then the second half starts and he's dressed again. So it was interesting to see him come back. I didn't think he would. Did you get an advantage? You know, what did you think of Brandon Banks coming back into the game?
I was surprised, because after he fumbled on, what was it, a kickoff, I believe? And it, like you said, it looked like he hurt his shoulder. He was taken off. He was standing right in front of me in a jacket with no shoulder pads on. And I'm thinking, holy crap, he's out of the game. And then later in the game, in the second half, I heard the announcer say Brandon Banks returns the ball. Either it was on a kickoff or it was on a punt. I don't really remember what it was. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, he thought it was Banks, but it's actually Sinkfield. Their numbers are kind of similar. And obviously he would think it was Banks, but then I see Banks out there and I'm like, oh, I guess he's back in the game. It was really surprising. I thought he was done for the game and maybe done for a lot longer because of the injury. But yeah, it was definitely nice to see him out there. And as much as I'm not a big proponent of, you know, he did run back that 2-point convert, but that does mean that the Ticats gave up a touchdown. So it's not exactly a great marker to be in the history books for, but history is history, and that was history. So it was pretty cool to see.
No, I'm just glad he's going to be okay, because he's I think he can be worked more into the offense like he was the week before in the first game against Ottawa. But I thought Sinkfield did a tremendous job coming in and replacing Banks. You know, he had that big return down to the the 4 yard line, and he's an experienced return guy as well. So Brandon Banks, hopefully this doesn't happen, but if he gets injured again, you know, we don't have any worries because Sinkfield's back there, you know, doing his thing. So it's good to have a great backup in that position.
Yeah, the Ticats have depth pretty much everywhere on the field, except unfortunately the one area where they really need it, which is quarterback. So again, this is a talented football team. They finished the season 10-8, which if you would have asked me if in August if this would have been acceptable, I would have blown a gasket and said absolutely not. But considering all the hardships they've dealt with over the last month and a half, I can't be too upset with a 10-win season, which is only like the third this team has had in 15 years or something.
I'm with you. I mean, I would have expected this team in, you know, in August to be, you know, around 12-6, 13-5, maybe even 14-4, the way that they're playing, you know, on level with Calgary and Edmonton. But, you know, since Claros went down, as long as it's a winning season, I'm pretty happy with that. 10-8 is pretty good. You know, you got to have perspective. For the longest time, I was so happy that the team was 9-9. So a winning record is always great to have.
If you look at the games they lost since Claros got hurt, the only one they really got blown out in was the BC game, and I guess to a certain extent this most recent game against Ottawa. You got to think in these close games, if Claros is in there, they probably win at least one or two of them. But it's foolish for us to get into the what-ifs. Claros got hurt. Unfortunately, that's how the season played out. 10 wins in a home playoff game. Maybe they can make another run to the Grey Cup. Who knows? Anything can happen on any given Sunday. But, you know, who knows? Who knows what could happen in these next few weeks?
Yeah, exactly. You know, anything can happen in the playoffs. So we shall see how they do. Hopefully they return to the Grey Cup. And, you know, and then there's just one game. So, you know, it'll be probably against Calgary Edmonton, which is a very tough task. But if they make it there, anything can happen. So we'll see what transpires.
Marcus Crandall's got a Grey Cup on his resume, and he's hardly a Hall of Fame quarterback. Most people probably don't even remember who he won his Grey Cup with. But yeah, Anything can happen. Let's just see how this all plays out. Bold predictions. We had a few this week. I'm counting those that we had a question, if you recall last week, about who would finish leading the team in receiving yards and touchdowns. So I'm adding those into our bold predictions for this week. So I'm going to give this one to you because you said that Luke Tasker would finish the season leading in yards and touchdowns. He was the team's leading receiver in yards, and he finished tied for touchdowns. So, oh, believe it or not, that is your first correct bold prediction of the year.
I'm still peeved about that 49 points when I but I've talked about that too much already. So, but yeah, I'm happy about that. Tasker's probably my favorite Ticat, so it's good to see him at the top of that list.
I went the opposite direction. I took Sinkfield in yards and Tasker in touchdowns, so I only got half right, but you got the full one right, so thumbs up to you. You had Tasker in this game as well with your bold prediction, 8 catches for 100 yards and a touchdown. He finished with 3 for 56. He didn't really do much. I had the Ticats winning the turnover battle, sack battle, and time of possession battle. They lost all three. Not by much. The turnover battle, they lost 4-3. The sack battle, they lost 3-2. Time of possession battle, Ottawa, who has just been ridiculous with their time of possession this year, had the ball 13 more minutes in Hamilton, so that wasn't even close. Maybe we'll get a little luck, or maybe we'll just get a little bit better in the playoffs, but just not a good season for our bowl predictions.
Yeah, maybe next season we'll get a couple more right.
Jim Popp has been named the head coach for the Montreal Alouettes for next season. What do you think about this? I'm shocked.
I am really surprised as well. You know, you talked about it all season on the podcast that, you know, maybe this is his downfall, taking over the team with his chest puffed out, you know, thinking that he can turn the thing around. But, you know, I think he was 3-7 this season. If you look at his all-time head coaching record, I'm sure it's well below 500. So the only explanation I could have is that he's really close with the owner, Wettenhall, and they just have such a rapport that he's not going to get fired at this point. You know, I guess he just has such a long leash that he can, maybe if they don't have a good record next year, he gets the heave-ho. But I was pretty surprised he came back as head coach. And I wouldn't be as surprised if he stepped down as head coach and just took over GM duties. But I'm pretty shocked that he came back as head coach.
you mentioned his career record, which is well below 500. 19-27 as a head coach in his career. I don't get why they would name him the head coach so soon after the season ended. Where was the harm in going out and maybe interviewing some other candidates or just doing anything? I just don't understand the need to announce this so soon, unless it was basically Jim Popp holding their feet to the fire and say, either give me this position or I'm walking, because there's a GM position available out in Saskatchewan where rumors were surfacing that maybe he was going to head there. I don't know, maybe he forced their hand, but this is just... He's not a good head coach. He's a great general manager, maybe the best in the game. He proves year in, year out that he can get talent. His downfall has been not being able to find a quarterback since Anthony Calvillo left, and they're still without a quarterback. I just don't understand why you make this move and why you make it so quickly.
Yeah, I don't understand it either. Maybe Glenn is the guy going forward, at least for next season, because I think he signed till for the 2016 season. And maybe that brings some stability to the position, and they... You know, Glenn, with all those veteran receivers, I think Glenn could do a pretty good job in Montreal if he has, you know, a training camp and a full season with them, learns the playbook. And, you know, they were a quarterback away from being a contender this season, because I think they have a ton of talent on offense and defense. But, yeah, I don't know why they wouldn't go out and at least look around, see what's out there for head coaching, and get Jim Popp back where he belongs in the GM chair. But they're going with him going forward, and I guess he's going to handle both duties. So we'll see how it goes next season, and maybe with Glenn there, they can turn it around.
But doesn't relying on Glenn just put them in the same position they were in a couple of years ago? Glenn is 36, about to turn 37. He's not the long-term solution there. They need to find the next, not Anthony Calvillo, but when they got Calvillo in 98, they groomed him and he became the starter there for over a decade. And they're relying on bringing in these veteran players, and I understand they got a lot of veteran talent on that team and kind of loaded up to win this year. And it failed miserably. But if they rely on Glenn next year, that just sets them back another year as far as I'm concerned, unless they truly think that Brandon Bridge, who looked for all reports very good in that final game against Saskatchewan, unless they think he's the guy going forward and they want to give him another year of sitting on the bench to groom him behind a guy like Glenn, I just don't see why relying on Glenn is the smart way to go.
Yeah, it's definitely a short-term solution over long-term, unless they're looking, like you said, with Bridge, grooming Bridge, or maybe Cato. You know, he came in and, you know, lit the league on fire his first couple of games and then kind of fell off. But I don't know if he has the, you know, he's shown that he has the talent, but can he actually be a starting quarterback in this league? We don't know. And same with Bridge. I also heard that he had a really good game against Saskatchewan, but it was against Saskatchewan in the last game of the season where it meant nothing, essentially. So it should be interesting to see who they go with as the backup, if they actually give Bridge a shot to be the number two guy, or if the Cato's the number two guy and Bridge is number three. I can't see Tanner Marsh coming back. That would just be a dumb decision, in my opinion. But yeah, it's, you know, maybe Glenn has a couple more years, you know, 36, you know, some quarterbacks can play till they're 40 or 40 plus. So we shall see if they try to groom Cato or Bridge, which one it is.
Now, the CFL announced their Grey Cup halftime show, and this always seems to generate way more controversy than is warranted, because I don't know about you, but I don't really give a damn about the CFL halftime show at the Grey Cup. It's a musical act. It's used to go get a bite to eat or maybe take a piss or something. But Fall Out Boy, who I didn't even know was still around, to be perfectly honest with you, is the Grey Cup halftime show, and it sparked a little bit of controversy. There seems to be this segment of people who think that the Grey Cup halftime show act should always be a Canadian artist, and then there's others who pretty much just don't care. Where do you fall on this?
I don't think it has to be a Canadian act. I mean, I get it. It's a CFL, you know, it's Canadiana, but... I don't know, I don't really care, like you, about the halftime show. I care about the football game. They want to bring in the biggest act that they can, and Fall Out Boy, you know, they're a big band back in the day, not that long ago, but yeah, I don't, like you, I'm not really up to date on current music, popular music, but I guess they're still a pretty big band, so it was a a good get for the CFL. I don't think it has to be Canadian every year. You know, it's nice to have a Canadian act. In Saskatchewan, I think it was Headley. They're Canadian, but they're god-awful, in my opinion. But, you know, no, I don't care. I think they have, you know, they have the pregame act, which I'm pretty sure is a Canadian artist, and they usually go country. Like, the last couple of years has been trending. They do a country artist before the kickoff and then a rock artist at halftime. So I think he's Canadian, so that throws in a little, you know, Canadiana for the folks that really want to see a Canadian artist play. But to me, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, last year was Imagine Dragons, and it was really the first halftime show I had ever really paid attention to. And I thought they put on a hell of a show. They're not a Canadian band, but I thought they were great. And then the 3 years prior to that, it was Headley, who you mentioned, who is god-awful. And I don't know much about them, but I don't listen to them, so I'll take your word for it that they're terrible. But, and then the year before that, it was Bieber. He's a Canadian guy, but everyone hated that because it's Justin Bieber at a football game. There's a Canadian guy. And the year before that, it was Nickelback, who was also Canadian, but they also get hated on by a bunch of people. So it seems like no matter who gets picked as the halftime performer, people are just going to complain and say it's stupid. I saw some people mention maybe Drake should have been the guy or The Weeknd, because those are two Canadian artists. But you got to remember, this is a halftime show being played in a football game in Winnipeg at the end of November. There's not a lot of people that are going to want to perform a free concert outdoors in Winnipeg at that time of year. And with Toronto hosting the Grey Cup next year, maybe they were saving Drake. He's a Toronto boy, so maybe they're saving a guy like Drake for the Toronto Grey Cup. You never know. But yeah, I think this just generates a lot more discussion, a lot more controversy than it has to, because it's really not that big a deal.
I remember going to the Grey Cup in 96, and I think it was in Hamilton. I think it was the Nylons or something, and they were like a doo-wop group or something. So, you know, they've come a long way with the halftime acts. And, you know, if they can get a big-name band, then that's great. I don't know if it draws anyone else in to watch that game. That usually wouldn't, but to me, it's not a big deal. I will watch the Grey Cup because I want to watch a football game. So that's about it.
So last week, you and I sat down and discussed the Ticats Player Awards that I was lucky enough to vote on this year. We ended up agreeing on every single award. Well, this past week, I got the ballot for the East Division Player Awards. And I got to think we're probably not going to agree on all of these. So how about, just like last week, we go through and we give our opinions on this stuff?
Yep, let's do it.
Okay, so we're going to start a little different this week because there was actually not just a player award, but I got to vote on the Coach of the Year for the East. There were five candidates: Ken Austin, Scott Milanovic, Rick Campbell, Tom Higgins, and Jim Popp. Now, obviously, no one's voting for Higgins or Pop because of how terrible their teams were. I just thought it was funny that Higgins was actually on the ballot. I can only imagine if someone would have voted for him for Coach of the Year. That'd be pretty funny. So to me, this came down between two guys. It came down to Milanovic and Rick Campbell. And this one actually took me a while. I hemmed and hawed, and I did this before the Ticats Red Blacks game on Saturday. And I sided with Scott Milanovic. As great as Rick Campbell has been and how great Ottawa has been, that's a huge turnaround. The distractions that Milanovic's Argos have had to deal with basically not playing a home game, and they're playing these home games away from home, and to still get that team to 10 wins when we, at the beginning of the season, I had Ottawa making the playoffs at the beginning of the season, so I thought they'd be a lot better. I didn't think anything of Toronto, and for them to get to 10 wins in a playoff spot, to me, that was impressive. So I gave my vote to Milanovic.
You know, I got to agree with you. The being on the road, they had a lot of new players coming in that didn't know the league, that were rookies in the league. To keep this team together and to get that many wins with, you know, Ricky Ray being out, Trevor Harris not getting, you know, much playing time before this season, you know, I think he probably had a big part in his good play early on. So, yeah, you got to give it to Milanovic. You know, Rick Campbell did a great job, you know. Who would have thought that they would have been 12-6 and first in the East? You know, that's a huge accomplishment by Campbell. 2 wins to 12 wins is just amazing. But you know, they have a great home crowd and they had all their home games. So if I had to choose, I'd give it to Milanovic just under the circumstances they had this season.
So most outstanding special teams player, I'm going to give you the four nominees from the East teams, and then you can tell me who you were going to pick, and then I'll tell you who I picked.
Okay.
So Montreal's nominee was Stephan Logan. Ottawa's was Antoine Pruneau. Toronto's was Brian Roll. And Hamilton's was Brandon Banks.
I'm going to be the homer and go with Banks just because he started off so hot and, you know, he's cooled off in the second half of the season. You know, I guess the other teams, special teams, have learned a bit better how to cover their punts and kick returns to limit Brandon Banks' production. But he still, you know, he hasn't scored a lot of touchdowns in the second half, but he still gets the probably one punt return a game that gives us good field position if it doesn't get called back on a illegal block or a holding. So he's still producing, just not getting touchdowns. So I'm going to have to give it to Banks.
I picked Banks as well for all the reasons you said. The only real competition I would have seen in this category is Stephon Logan. And if Logan gets the nomination, I won't be surprised. But yeah, I went with Banks as well. So for most outstanding offensive lineman, Montreal's nominee was Jeff Parrott. Ottawa's was Sir Vincent Rogers. Toronto's was Gregory Van Roten, and Hamilton's was Mike Filer.
I'm going to have to go with Rogers. I mean, Stanley Bryan was the big name offensive tackle free agent signing in the offseason to Winnipeg, and it's hard to tell if he's done a good job or not, but overall, the Winnipeg offensive line has been pretty bad again, and I think that Sir Vincent Rogers came into Ottawa, and it was a under-the-radar kind of signing compared to Stanley Bryant, but I think he's done the better job. I think the offensive line for Ottawa has really improved this season. Burris has had a ton of time back there, seen in his numbers. I mean, the most passing yards he's ever had. That's due to the offensive line and the new receivers that he has at his disposal, but I'm going to have to give it to Rogers just because of the improvement of that Ottawa offensive line.
God damn it. 3 for 3, I picked Rogers as well for every reason you said. Ottawa's offensive line was terrible last year. Burris had absolutely no time to make any throws, to do anything. That offense was terrible. They bring in Rogers, who said at the beginning of the season he was signing for whoever paid him the most money, and that was Ottawa. And usually when that happens, you don't see players excel all that much. You tend to find that they take the paycheck and they kind of dog it. But Rogers has been awesome all year. So, yeah, he easily got the nomination for me. Most outstanding rookie. Montreal's nominee was kicker Boris Beattie. Ottawa's was Forrest Hightower. Toronto's was Vidal Hazelton. And Hamilton's was Terrence Tolliver.
I'm going to go, because it might be surprising, but with a kicker, I'm going to go with Beattie. I mean, I saw him play in the preseason. I thought, he shanked a couple punts and missed a couple field goals. And I thought, oh boy, this guy's going to get cut. But then he really turned it around when the season started. I mean, he has a monster leg. His punts are usually huge. They're, towering high punts for a lot of yardage. He's been money on field goals. He can hit the long field goal. He's super accurate. So I'm going to go with the rookie of the year. I'm going to go with Boris Beattie.
You've got to be kidding me. That's who I told you. I did. The other nominees, I'll be honest, I don't know much about Forrest Hightower. That's not a name I'm super familiar with. And I've watched a fair amount of Ottawa games, but I couldn't even tell you what position he plays. And that, you know what? That reflects poorly on me. But Hazelton was benched for a bit, and he was good early, but not all that effective late. And Tolliver missed a bunch of games. So it was kind of Beattie or no one, really. So, yeah, I went with Beattie as well. I thought he's got a booming leg. He really picked his game up as the season went on. He looks like he's going to be the kicker in Montreal for a long time to come. I was really impressed by him. So, oh my God, another one we get the same. And looking at the rest of my picks, I'm not sure if we're going to disagree the rest of the way, but let's plug along anyway. And we will go next to Most Outstanding Canadian. Ottawa's nominee was Brad Sinopoli. Toronto's was Cleon Lang. Hamilton's was Ted Laurent, and Montreal's was Luc Brodeur-Jourdain.
I'm probably going to be the same on this, but I got to go with Sinopoli. He had a good season last year, but this year I think he's shown that he is one of the best, receivers in the league. He has great hands. I think he leads the league in yards after catch. He just makes plays, and he's such a reliable guy. So he's really the former quarterback, all that stuff for the GGs, whatever. But he's really made the transition from quarterback to receiver, and he's one of the best in the league now. So I got to go with Sinopoli.
Yep, Sinopoli, of course. Easy pick, no-brainer. Yeah. Everything you just said, and then some. He's really turned into a solid, dependable player, and maybe the best Canadian receiver in the game right now. He's got youth on his side. He was a no-brainer pick. So Most outstanding defensive player. For Montreal, we have Winston Venable. For Ottawa, we have Damaso Munoz. For Toronto, we have Greg Jones. And for Hamilton, we have Simone Lawrence.
Well, I think I got to go with Greg Jones. He's came, out of nowhere. I'm not sure who we replaced. It might have been...
Was it Shea Emery?
Might have been. Or, was he playing beside Greenwood?
Oh, maybe. I'm trying to think. Yeah, Greenwood probably replaced Emery, and then Jones filled in for Greenwood when Greenwood got hurt. Yeah, you're probably right there.
Yeah, so he comes into the league. Another guy that Barker brings in that we've never heard of, who has a spectacular season. He's, one of the leaders on the Argos defense, on a young defense. They have a young secondary back there. I know he's a linebacker, but he's just really stood out amongst a lot of talented linebackers on the Toronto defense. You got Greenwood there, who unfortunately has been injured. Brandon Isaac's a veteran that's still a good player. So he's been one of the best players for the Argos all season long. So I gotta give the nod to Greg Jones.
Well, we finally disagree on something. This, to me, was the hardest one to pick. All four of these players have been really good this year. But I narrowed my choices down to Venable and Lawrence, and then I made my pick and then sent my ballot in and then immediately regretted it. I think I went homer on this one. I took Lawrence, and I think I should have taken Venable. He is up there in the league lead in tackles. He has been a playmaker all season for the Alouettes. But I chose Lawrence, and I got to stand by it. So, yeah, I'm regretting that decision now. But at the time, I thought Simone Lawrence has been so good all season on a number of different reasons. He makes plays. He gets tackles. He's the heart and soul of that defense. So we finally got one different, and we would have got a different no matter who I picked. But I think this was an award where I think all of the four guys, regardless of who gets the nomination, are more than deserving of getting it. So now we go to the big one, most outstanding player. Montreal's nominee was Stefan Logan. Ottawa's was, surprise, surprise, Henry Burris. Toronto's was Trevor Harris. And Hamilton's was Zach Collaros. I got the feeling that we're both going to have the same guy here, but who's your pick?
Yeah, I got to go, Burris. I mean, after last season, it was just like, wow, maybe this guy's done. It wasn't all his fault, but he did not look good. His passes were, a lot of overthrows and underthrows, and he just didn't have a good season last year. This year, with the talent around him and the better protection, he's just been on fire. Just watch last game against the Ticats. He was great almost the whole game. There was a couple lulls in there, but he's just been on target all season long. He's passed for the most yards in his career, which I think was set with the Ticats in the Cortez year. So, and he, I was more than happy with his performance for the Ticats that year. It was just we've talked about it before, it was the defense that brought us down. But he just looks like he's been good Hank all year. I know some people hate the good Hank, bad Hank stuff, but he's got to be the MOP. I mean, Bo Levi Mitchell in the West has had a good season, but he's not even close to the numbers that Burris has. So I got to go with Burris. Trevor Harris had a good start. Maybe if he continued the way he was playing, he would have been in the conversation with Burris, but you got to give the nod to him.
Yeah, the only demerit on Burris's account is the touchdown passes, 26 TDs, and he had 6 in the last game of the season. Isn't a ton, but leads the league in passing. His completion percentage was over 70%, which is by far the best number of his career. Like you said, his passing numbers were the best of his career. Yeah, Burris is a no-brainer, especially with such a bounce-back year from the year before. Yeah, this was a no doubt easy pick. Collaros would have won this award had he stayed healthy, but we keep talking about if Collaros had done this, but he didn't stay healthy, so yeah, this was Burris's award to win, and I don't see anyone from the West touching him when it comes to this. So he's won the award as far as I'm concerned. And when we discuss my picks for most outstanding player when I get that ballot, probably in a week or so, I think there we'll have a similarly short discussion on who the MOP of the year is.
It's got to be Burris. Now, is this his second? If he wins it, is this his second MOP?
Yeah, I think he won it in 2010. And he had other seasons where he deserved to win it. But yeah, this would only be his second. instead of talking about three games that essentially meant nothing, the only game of the week last week that meant anything in the standings was Hamilton versus Ottawa. We've already touched on that in great detail. So we're going to eschew talking about the other three games of week 20, and instead we're going to offer up a little bit of a playoff preview. We're going to do our regular Ticats game preview in a bit, but we're going to start talking about the West semifinal, which is BC going into McMahon Stadium to take on the defending Grey Cup champion Calgary Stampeders. What are you looking for in this game?
I'm looking at how Jennings plays. I believe he's a starter. They're not going to start Lule, right?
I can't imagine. I haven't heard they're going to start Lule, but that would be... I mean, it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility for a Wally Buono team. I know he's not the coach, but he did something similar in the Grey Cup 10 or so years ago when he had the MOP and Casey Printers, benched him in the Grey Cup for Dave Dickinson. They lost to Toronto. I didn't think that game was in Ottawa, too, so... it wouldn't be.
Yeah, I went to that. I was at that game.
Actually. Oh, there you go. So you've been to a couple games in Ottawa then.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, it was a one in the regular season and a one in the Grey Cup. Yeah.
Who was the halftime performer that year? Do you remember?
God.
Yeah, exactly. Right? That tells you how much halftime performances mean when you can't even remember who it was when you went to the game.
Yeah, I don't remember. Oh, wait. No, might have been the Hip. Maybe. I don't recall, though.
Okay, you know what? We got to look this up, because I got to find out who the halftime performer. You think it was the Hip? Let's see. 2004 Grey Cup halftime. Let's see. It was... It was the Tragically Hip.
You took
you a while to get that out of the brain, though, but yeah, it
was
the Hip.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I remember the Argos winning that year and being thoroughly disgusted, but I've been to two Grey Cups where the Argos won, so that kind of sucked. But I remember that distinctly, that I was questioning why Casey Printers didn't get the start, because he played so well all year. But, you know, I was a big Dickinson fan, so... But anyways, what were we talking about?
the West Semi, BC at Calgary. What are you looking for in this game?
Okay, so Jennings, you know, he's had a good run of games. You know, he's been really impressive, a rookie quarterback coming in. I think he runs the Tedford system really well. I think that he likes to run an up-tempo offense, and I think that Jennings fits that really well. So I'm going to see how he performs against a really good Calgary defense. And I'm kind of hoping that Calgary wins this game, because I don't want to see a 7-11 team in a West Final or a Grey Cup. I know that they earned their spot. They're in the playoffs. And, you know, anything can happen. But I'm just looking for, you know, also on Calgary's side, if the Calgary offense can really play up to their potential. I think that BC's defense has been really coming on strong in the last couple weeks. So it'll be interesting to see how Calgary's offense plays against BC's defense that's been really coming on strong, too. So it should be an interesting game. I think that Calgary will win, but I think that BC will give them a good go.
I think it's going to be a lot closer than people expect, but I just think Calgary's got too many weapons on offense for BC to really make this anything closer than maybe a 10-point or 12-point game, you know what I mean? I'm like you, I don't want to see a 7-11 team advance in the playoffs, because as much as they've earned their way in, it was more of a war of attrition between who was the best of these four really bad teams, and they just happen to be the best of the bunch of Winnipeg, Saskatchewan, Montreal, and themselves. I just can't see them going into Calgary, who's going to be angry that they're not on a bye this week. They're going to want to go into Edmonton in a week from now and put a beating on the Eskimos as well. I don't see any way in which the Lions can escape with this victory and extend their playoff run. I think you're going to see a lot of Jerome Messam. I think he's going to run the ball down the throat of the Lions defense. And that'll set up all types of plays to Eric Rogers, Marque McDaniel, and all those other players. Calgary's defense is good. This just seems to me like maybe BC keeps it close for a little while, and then we get sort of a late third, early fourth quarter juggernaut run by the Stampeders to blow this one wide open.
It's interesting to see the top two running backs in the league, yardage-wise, I believe. Both Canadians, obviously. Andrew Harris and Jerome Messam, we're going to probably see a bunch of carries from both of those guys, see who comes out on top, because I think it'll be Messam. I think that they have probably the better offensive line, and he's just on such a roll lately that he's probably going to run all over BC's defense and show that he's worth signing for next year. So, yeah, like you said, they'll probably give the ball to Messam a bunch, and then that'll open up avenues for Rogers and McDaniel and Jeff Fuller and Joe West. It goes on and on and on for Calgary. They have a lot of depth at the receiver position. So I think it'll be close like you think, but then Calgary will pull away late in the game.
Okay, so let's move to the game that interests us the most, obviously. It is the East semifinal in Hamilton at Tim Hortons Field. Ticats and Argos. These two teams don't meet in the playoffs a lot. The last time was 2013 in the East final, which was one of the best games I think I've ever attended. I don't know if this one will match that in intensity, but this is a great rivalry that I'm glad is getting a marquee match on the playoff stage once again. Doesn't happen often, so we got to take advantage of these. What are you looking for in this game? What do you think the Ticats have to do to I don't want to say upset the Argos, but at this point, these are two, I think, fairly evenly matched teams. So what do the Ticats got to do offensively, defensively, on special teams, in any manner? What do you think they got to do to get this win?
Well, I'll pretty much say this every game preview, but especially in this game, you gotta rattle Ray. If he has time back there, he's going to pick apart any defense. So, you know, I'm sure that they're going to be sending blitzes, but, you know, they have to get to him quickly, because if he reads that before the guy gets there, he's going to pick apart the defense. So just pressure Ray, get him off kilter, get him uncomfortable, and that'll be a big part of the game if they can pressure Ray, because if he doesn't have a lot of time, he doesn't perform well. So on defense, you just shut down whoever started. You know, Tackard was in there last week, and he looks like he did in 2012. He had his speed. You know, he's cutting well. You know, he had that ankle injury, a devastating ankle injury a couple years ago, and it looked like he was going to be retired. But he looks like he's back on track. So I don't know if he's going to be playing, but if it's him, if it's Whitaker, Ray likes, or the Argonaut offense likes to do those passes to the running backs a lot. You know, they do a lot of dump off passes to the running backs. So shut that down. Make sure that they don't get first downs on the dump off passes, and that's what they got to do on defense.
One of Hamilton's defensive Achilles' heels has been not being able to defend these 4 to 6 yard dump off passes, and they allow these backs and these receivers to take these little passes over the middle and make 12, 15 yards out of them. So yeah, the Argos are probably going to try to do that with whomever is back there. If it's Whitaker, if it's Cackard, if it's Curtis Steele, who knows who's going to be back there. Even Anthony Coombs has been getting some playing time out of the backfield. So there's a lot of guys on that Argonauts offense that can cause some troubles for Hamilton's defense. And with Ricky Ray back there, you know, anything's possible. Ray is, he's a Hall of Famer. We've mentioned it before. We'll mention it until he's in the Hall of Fame. He's a Hall of Fame player. To get him back and to see him knock some rust off in the last couple of games, it's got me a little worried, to be blunt. Offensively, it's the same as it's been. You mentioned it when you started talking that we seem to be harping on the same points every single week. But until it happens, we're going to keep harping on them. And it's don't turn the damn ball over. They hurt themselves immensely against Ottawa the last 2 weeks with turnovers, and they're going to probably be starting, well, they're definitely going to be starting a guy who doesn't have a ton of starting experience, whether it's Matthews or Masoli or Harris. Use the running game. Again, this past week, C.J. Gable was not as involved as he should have been. He ended up with some decent numbers, but he had a couple of big runs at the end of the game that essentially were meaningless. Again, he only got 9 carries. He converted those 9 carries into 81 yards, but like I said, a bunch of them came really late in the game. I think it was the last 2 plays he had like a 17-yard and a 19-yard run. Get him involved to take the pressure off the quarterbacks. I don't know if Ken Austin is stubborn in the fact that he just doesn't want to run the football and is sick of hearing people talk about how he should run the football and therefore he's not going to run the football. But you have C.J. Gable, and I said this last week, bloody well use him. He's there for a reason. He's one of the best, most dynamic running backs in the league. To see him just not being involved in the offense is frustrating.
You know, he was going out wide to like the wide receiver position quite a bit. He's been doing that since he's been coming back. He had a really nice catch in that Ottawa game by the sidelines there, where he kept his feet in and you know, reached out and really impressed me with that catch. But you're right, he has to get the ball more. You don't have an MOP at quarterback anymore, so take some of the pressure off of whoever's at quarterback. I think it's going to be Masoli. He showed the most promise out of all the quarterbacks, I think, in a short amount of time, like three quarters. So, you know, he runs the ball quite a bit, so maybe they're going to mix it up with Gable and Masoli running the ball. But, you know, they had a little bit of trouble, Masoli, with the read option player, you know, trying to hand the ball off, and they're just fumbling around, and they had a turnover because of that bad exchange. So they need to clean that up if Mazzoli's in there. And you're right, just give Gable the ball. Hand it off to him. Pass it to him. He's a dangerous weapon, so we might as well use him. We've been talking about it all season, so yeah, you got to get the running game going. And this is the point of the season. You know, it's the playoffs now. You got to get it going. It's going to be probably cold in Hamilton, so the passing game isn't going to be there as much. Give the ball to Gable.
This is going to be a tight, hard-fought game where I think whichever team can run the ball more effectively is going to win. We know the Argos can run the football. We've listed off their running backs just a few minutes ago that are all capable of putting up big numbers. Hamilton has a guy like that, and it's time they use him. This is the time of year. It's do or die. This is a win-or-go-home game. If they don't win this, their season is over, and essentially this was ending up being a complete disappointment from where we thought they'd be at the beginning of the year and at midseason. And sure, catastrophe struck in September, but that doesn't mean that this team can't rally around who they have and make a run here. But they have to utilize all their weapons. And if they get down early and have to abandon the run game, I don't like where this game will be headed. But if they can use the run game and shorten the game, get some time off the clock, put together long, sustained drives, I don't see why the Ticats can't beat the Argos.
I agree. I mean, do you know of the status of Tolliver? Because he's been out for a while, and he's a better option in there than Underwood. So have you heard anything about his injury?
I haven't. I had heard that he may have been able to play against Ottawa this week, but obviously they didn't make that change, so it didn't happen. I'm hoping, like you, that he is back for this game, because he is a difference maker and has proven to be a difference maker, especially as a deep threat in the offense. And with Masoli likely getting the start, I would say, he's got an arm on him. So if you're going to have a guy like Tolliver there, we've seen numerous times this year where he's taken bombs to the house for touchdowns. So I really hope he's back in there, because I'm not even sure what the injury was. The Ticats are very secretive when it comes to player injuries. You don't really hear a lot out of them when it comes to guys. I still haven't heard officially what Ryan Bauman's injury is. So, and we know he's probably done for the season, but I say probably because we haven't heard anything. So knowing how long Tolliver will be out or what, I obviously it's not an answer I have. I'm hoping he's back. So I guess we'll see when the depth chart comes out or when they finally get out there and get some practice time in for this game. We'll know what's going on.
Yeah, and to the receivers, I mean, not all of them, but Bakari Grant had a tough game last week. He had a chance to score a touchdown if he makes that catch. You can't let the quarterback down. I mean, once again, it's not Claris back there, so the receivers have to make the plays if the pass is there. They can't be dropping balls. They can't be throwing away opportunities for points. So, you know, the receivers have to be at the very top of their game if we want to advance against Ottawa next week and then win the game against Ottawa. They have to be almost perfect. Like, no drops, no fumbles, just don't turn over the ball and catch the damn thing.
The Argos have not won in Tim Hortons Field yet, and how terrible would it be if they got their first win against them in the playoff game?
Yeah, that would be horrific.
Okay, so let's make some bold predictions for this game. What do you got?
Whew. Okay, I guess I'm going to go with Gable. I'm hoping that he gets more involved in the game. I'm going to go 90 rushing yards. I'm reluctant to say 100 because I don't think I'll get there, but you know, they are bold predictions. So, hell with it. I'll go 100 yards rushing and 2 touchdowns on the ground.
That is bold, considering the Ticats. When was the last 100-yard rusher they had? Was it Gable in Week 5?
Probably, against Saskatchewan, I think.
Yeah. Well, Ray Hawley finished the year as their leading rusher, and he had, 300 yards rushing or so. And he hasn't played since, I'm thinking, the game against Montreal. And you know what? I don't even know when the last time he didn't play was, so it's been a while since Holly's been on the field, and he was the team's leading rusher, so they don't run the football. So, yeah, that's a pretty bold prediction. I'm going with the Ticats defense. I'm saying that they get 3 interceptions, and they find a way to find the end zone at least once.
That's pretty bold, too, because, you know, Ricky Ray doesn't throw a ton of interceptions. So, yeah, if that happens, then, you know, we're probably going to win the game.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, Twitter questions?
Yeah, not as many as last week. There was probably the most you ever had last week. So I got 2 here. This one's from Daryl_Esksfan. Will it be a mistake for the Argos to start Ray, given the fact that Harris has more game experience this year?
I don't think so. It's Ricky Ray, man. If he's healthy and he's played a couple games, how do you not play him? So maybe it's not the greatest idea in the world to have pulled Harris to begin with, but we saw him have almost a complete meltdown in the game against Montreal that was in Hamilton. So I think it's a no-brainer to start Ray.
I don't see why you wouldn't. I mean, Ray was a starter going into the year. They were hoping that he was going to be back at Labor Day. That didn't happen. I just think that Ray gives them the best chance to win. So they're going to start whoever they think is going to get them the victory. So no, I don't think it's a wrong decision. I think that, well, hopefully it's a wrong decision. Hopefully it goes terribly for Ray this week. But I think that Milanovic makes the right choice in Ray.
Yeah, they rode Harris until he hit a wall. And they always had Ricky Ray in their back pocket. So I'm sure at some point this was bound to happen. Harris just happened to have an amazing start, an MOP-like start to the season. And then he fell off. And this is why you have a guy like Ricky Ray, throw him in there. This is what he's paid to do. He's a highly paid quarterback. It's a playoff game. It's a must win. It's win or go home. I don't see any reason why you wouldn't give him the start.
Now one from Joe, USFL Tecmo. Might be a little early for this question, but which quarterback returns next year to back up Caleros?
I think it's Jeff Matthews. I think Jeff Matthews is going to be the backup next year. I actually think all three guys could be back next year. I think Masoli is a free agent, so maybe he goes elsewhere, but I don't really think the Ticats are going to make many changes to their quarterbacking hierarchy.
No, I'd have to agree. You know, depending on how Masoli plays in the playoffs, if he plays, if he, you know, gets them to the Grey Cup and don't really necessarily think this is going to happen. If they win a Grey Cup with Masoli, then you got to think that he's going to be re-signed or maybe go somewhere else. If that happens, you know, he'll probably be a commodity in the free agent market. But yeah, I think that it'd probably be Matthews and Masoli coming back as 2 and 3, and maybe Jacory Harris as well. But he didn't, you know, he only had 2 quarters to play or a quarter and a half, but he didn't perform that well. So I'm going to have to go with Matthews and Masoli as 2 and 3.
I don't really see them making many changes to their quarterbacking depth chart just because, like, we talked last week and we've talked all season about getting a veteran backup, but if it comes at the cost of being able to sign players elsewhere, I don't see why you just don't go with the guys you have. They'll have a year more experience in the offense. Matthews will have had starting experience. It just seems like that's really the only move they're going to make. So I got one question this week, and it comes from Rossere on Twitter, and he asks, do you see Kent Austin being like Bill Cowher and staying as long as he wants?
Yes. I think that, you know, the Bob Young regime wanted Austin when they hired Cortez. You know, Austin was their first choice. You know, it was a long shot to get Austin here, I think. Not many people thought that Austin was going to come back to the CFL. They got him. He's been you know, a great success. He hasn't won the championship yet, but I think that he has, as long as he keeps producing in the regular season and winning playoff games, getting us to the Grey Cup, I think he'll be there for many years to come. You know, all coaches have their time limit at a certain job. They all get fired eventually, but I think that, you know, Austin can have a 10-15 year run if he really wants it.
Yeah, I think he's here as long as he wants to be. He's also the team's general manager, and he's like their vice president of football operations. Like, he's their football czar to
French fries.
Yeah, like, yeah, he picks the menus for the concessions and all that stuff. He's going to be here. He's going to be here for as long as he wants to be here, simply because getting rid of him would be, you'd be overhauling the entire football operations department, and I just don't see that happening. He's been successful. Back-to-back Grey Cup seasons, he's got the team in the playoffs again this year. He probably, again, I hate saying if Caleros didn't get hurt, but Caleros doesn't get hurt, this team's probably the favorite to win the Grey Cup. So, again, I don't see him leaving unless he wants to leave, and he seems to be happy here. He talked about how this is the area he wanted to be in, because this is where his family has friends and all that stuff. So I think he's Ticats head coach for quite some time. He's Ticats GM for even longer than that. He's here until he decides to leave.
Yeah, I don't think he's leaving until he at least wins one championship. And even after that, I don't see him, you know, taking off anywhere unless, like, something comes up, like a NFL job. And I don't know if his interest is to do that. You know, I don't think that that's going to come up. But, yeah, unless something incredible job opportunity comes his way, I don't see him leaving anytime soon.
All right. So with that, we are done once again for the week. So everyone out there, don't forget, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you want to have your questions answered, you can hit Mike or myself up on Twitter. Give him your Twitter handle, Mike.
@Mike_Ticats.
And I'm @Josh_Smith_82. And you can always post questions and comments in the Three Down Nation comment section. We're always looking at those, and that's a great place to get a much longer form of a question in there. So, for Podski Wee Wee this week, I am Josh Smith.
And I am Mike Graham. Argos suck.